Which one do I want to do?
Pop one on me. That sounded gross.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me from San Diego is my co-host, Keith Foster.
And with me is the host of this mess, Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles.
Hey, you know what? I do a lot of work so that when it's finally online, it doesn't seem like as big of a mess as it is.
I actually genuinely appreciate that. I have thought about and tried like brainstorming ideas for other podcasts, like kind of my own thing.
Sure.
And I kind of get stopped short because I'm like, yeah, but then I'll have to edit it and do all that, like uploading and all that bullshit. So I do appreciate it.
Yes. It might be good to do just for empathy training alone.
Nah. I don't care that much.
Why is this other person that I'm talking to who isn't Cassidy going off on all this nonsense? I'm going to have to edit all of this out.
Yeah, I just... Nah, I also kind of have stopped myself just because, I don't know. Do I really need to do another thing?
Do we need more hobbies? No, probably
not. Here's the thing. I want one of my hobbies to become a career. So the more hobbies I have, I guess, I don't know.
Yeah. If only either of us were really interested, like genuinely interested in like banking and finance, then maybe we can make our hobby a career.
Oh, like if only our hobbies were boring, dumb shit.
Yeah, like we just loved spreadsheets. Like that's what we were really into, is just like screwing around on Excel.
I actually know that person. Like well, for real.
You are a data entry person in your slave job.
Well, no. I try not to publicize that too much.
Right.
But no, it's actually. I don't want to out her too much.
Yikes.
But it's someone associated with the show Tonight in San Diego.
I decided at the beginning of the show, rather than just trying to randomly come up with bullshit, I might try a new segment. We'll try it right now. I'm stealing this from a podcast I listen to called The E Word, but that's okay. Everything else I've done on this podcast, I've shamelessly stolen from other ones I was listening to. So what have we been watching this week?
Isn't that kind of the point of Netflix homework?
No, I mean outside of it. I mean in our everyday lives, not as show work.
Sure.
And this can also include anything that's on TV. This can include, I don't know, if you saw a play or something. I don't know.
Okay. No, I like this.
Comedy, whatever.
Yeah. I have a few things. Do you just want one?
Just whatever. What have you been watching this week?
Well, because a lot of shows have started coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll talk about two that I've been enjoying. I watched the first episode of the new HBO show Barry, starring Bill Hader.
Right, right.
I really enjoyed the first episode. It just started, so I have another one in the queue, but it's a very dark comedy about a hitman who, through circumstance during one of his hits, ends up accidentally ending up on stage in an acting class.
Okay.
And finds that he likes the attention, so he's trying to make a transition in his life from being a hitman to becoming an actor. And so, yeah, it's really dark. It's pretty violent. And the other thing was that they want the violence to seem like really realistic and gritty. So, yeah, so far, I really dug the tone of the first episode. I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, that could be cool.
Yeah. And the other one is another TV show, AP Bio. It's Glenn Howerton from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. He played Dennis. That's Glenn Howerton, right?
I don't know their names except for Charlie Day.
Yeah. So Dennis, he has a new show on a network, like I think it's ABC, NBC, I don't know. He has a new show with Patton Oswalt that I just caught up on, called AP Bio, where he is like a former Harvard professor who lost his job, and now he had to like move to a small town and become a high school teacher, and he's just like awful. He's basically playing Dennis still,
right?
But if Dennis was a high school teacher, yeah, and it's pretty fun. And Patton Oswalt is like this pushover who wants him to like him, and yeah.
And this is network television?
Yeah. So the show was created by Mike O'Brien. From Saturday Night Live. He was a writer on Saturday Night Live. He was like a featured player for a season. And I believe it's also produced by Seth Meyers. It's very absurd. It has sort of an SNL... It has sort of an SNL movie sensibility, but a series version of that. Yeah. Which is kind of cool because, you know, now that I think of it, can't really think of any, like, SNL TV shows besides SNL that have
someone could argue that 30 Rock was sort of an extension of that sensibility, but it was very sitcom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so far it's been pretty fun. What about you? What have you been watching?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up SNL. I was rewatching Wayne's World for like the 600th time a few days ago. Just had an inkling, a mood, an itch.
Okay, just a nostalgia.
Yeah, just to watch Wayne's World. It's like comfort food. Like, there's some movies that are like that for me. It's like, if I don't really want to, like, think about anything, but I just want to enjoy something.
Yeah.
Then I just, like, throw on Wayne's World because it's a good laugh and I can enjoy a lot of things about it. But it was one of those movies that while I was watching it, I realized one thing I wanted to do with this podcast that we didn't get to do very much. A while back, me and Richard recorded an audio commentary for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because it's a movie that we talk about a lot and reference a lot, and it comes up a lot. And I was trying to think of movies that we could do that with you, and I think Wayne's World might be a good candidate, because I feel like there's a lot to talk about there. And I also wrote a paper on Penelope Spheeris' career, so I know a little bit.
Weird. So how does that work? You just watch the movie and talk over it?
Yeah, I mean, we were in the same room at the time, so it had to be a situation like that. But yeah, pretty much we watched it separately, wrote notes. Then when we came together, kind of had an idea of what we wanted to say when. And the only thing that's different than a podcast is that we're talking along to the movie and you can't cut.
Interesting. Did you guys, like, stream it?
Yeah, we uploaded the commentary onto Podbean like we do everything else, and we also...
Yeah, but I mean, like, we could just, like, live stream it, since there's no cuts or editing, just, like, live
yeah,
stream
at the time, this was it. Actually kind of a while back, so I'm not even sure if, like, Google Hangout or anything like that existed yet. Yeah, I mean, that would be an option. There's the stuff we could talk about.
Alright, I guess rate the show if any of that sounds fun to you.
Yes,
listeners.
Absolutely. If you want to hear my hot takes on Wayne's World.
25-year-old movie.
Hey, that has to be a movie a lot of people have seen.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking about Ready Player One, and we're also going to be talking about Half Nelson in our Netflix homework. We do have a couple news stories here, and we also got some audio from a friend of the show, Jen Anaya, who worked on Ready Player One. We're going to play that before we launch into our critique, but let's go ahead and get started with the movie news.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
Let's do the one, the top of the day, Keith.
Yeah. You want me to introduce this one?
Yeah, go ahead.
I guess Steven Spielberg just said that he's considering introducing a female version of Indiana Jones after this rumored fifth movie is supposed to complete with Harrison Ford or whatever. Mm-hmm. Which, I don't know. Even that movie sounds like it's never going to happen, and I kind of don't care if it does.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this would be like a reboot? I don't know.
Sure.
But he said that it would be... He's considering doing a female version of the character.
Okay. Yeah, so this seems to be a thing at the moment. We'll see. I think this is going to hinge on a couple things. I think it's going to hinge on the success or the viability of a fifth Indiana Jones movie and how excited people still are for that. I feel like that'll do well. Even though I pretty much have no hype for it, given how popular the last few Star Wars movies have been, and now, you know, with Harrison Ford no longer in that franchise, people might want to follow him into another Indiana Jones movie. So I feel like that'll probably do well, and they might learn the wrong lessons from it.
You want to know what I think of this?
Oh, well, one last thing. I think This also has to hinge on the success or failure of Ocean's 8, which comes out later this year. If that movie does as badly or has as bad of press as the Ghostbusters remake, then I think there might put the kibosh on the gender swapping trend in Hollywood, which, you know, if that movie did bad or a bunch of sexists like ranted online about it and caused a bunch of bad press or whatever, and they decided from that point on, okay, let's not do this. I think that again is sort of learning the wrong lesson. But I digress. What were you going to say?
Yeah, I just don't care about this franchise being revived in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. I don't care about a fifth movie. I don't want it. I don't need it. The fourth one wasn't good. I just don't know. Like, what are we going to get out of seeing an old, crusty Indiana Jones? Like, I just don't. What's the point? What's the point of doing a fifth one? Mm-hmm. And then we're rebooting it as a female version. I'm all for feminism. I'm all for equality. But just like gender swapping characters, I don't see how that's equality. Like, I don't care. It feels too political. Mm-hmm. For me to get behind it as like a story thing. You know, we've already introduced Indiana Jones' bastard son. Is he going to have like a bastard daughter? Is it going to be a total reboot? At that point,
I think that's what it would be. Is it would be Indiana Jones would be a lady.
So it's like a total. It's just, I don't know. I just don't really care. Like, Indiana Jones is. It's a little different to me than like Ghostbusters or even Ocean's 8, where it's like a specific character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's been like talk about wanting a female James Bond. I understand the idea behind it. It just practically, it just doesn't really click for me. And it's not like, it's not a, oh, he has to be a man kind of thing. It's like, well, this is a very specific character, and I feel like we've sort of seen his adventures. I don't know how what's a female Indiana Jones going to be that's different than Tomb Raider. You know what I mean? Like, that's right.
That's what I was sort of that. Don't we have Tomb Raider? In fact, we have two versions of Tomb Raider now.
I think what it comes down to is,
is it going to be good? Like, again, I don't necessarily believe any kind of premise can, you know, damn something just from the premise alone. I think it has to be, you know, seen through.
And yeah, well, that's all I'm saying is right now this feels like a stunt at the moment.
Yeah.
Because it's like a popular... not even popular, it's a controversial thing. Like, it's going to get attention either way.
Yeah, and you get some built-in press because of it. And also, I think this move of gender swapping, and this is what kind of makes me more upset than the fact of just doing it alone. Because I honestly don't care if they want to do Ocean's 8 or if they want to do a female version of Ghostbusters, that kind of stuff. As long as it's written well. My issues with it is it seems like it's a cynical move to put an old dead franchise on life support.
Exactly. And that's why I'm like, I just don't feel like we need it. Even a female James Bond to me makes more sense because there's the whole lore that, oh, maybe James Bond is just a code name for whatever agent is 007. Yeah. So to me, there's like a, sort of a built-in lore where that makes a little more sense.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Indiana Jones, I'm like, okay, it's such a specific character to me that it's weird to think of it reboot in general.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not like up in arms about it. If it moves forward, it's not like I'm...
Yeah.
Like, no, Indiana Jones can't be a woman. I just don't care, really.
Fair enough. So let's see if you do care about this. So it looks like there has been trouble in paradise with the X-Men movies. I'm reading here off of Birth, Movies, Death, who are quoting something else, that the New Mutants movie, as well as X-Men Dark Phoenix, have been postponed. The release dates have been postponed for reshoots. And it says here, the earliest availability for everyone to return was August or September of this year, which would leave just a couple of months to complete necessary visual effects for the new scenes. That wasn't enough time, so Fox decided to push Dark Phoenix's release date to February to give everyone time necessary to complete the needed additional photography. So we're talking almost a year from now for Dark Phoenix.
Reshoots for photography isn't that uncommon.
No, that happens all the time, especially for effects, or if the line didn't happen right, or there's lots of different various reasons why reshoots happen. But
yeah, I think it's more troubling that they're thinking a February release date, just because traditionally that's sort of been a dumping ground month. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think there's the hype behind the X-Men franchise. Like there is like a Black Panther or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like there's not a lot, as much confidence as maybe there once was. Otherwise, why wouldn't they be pushing for like a summer release?
Right. When it comes to New Mutants, it says that the reshoots that the studio wants are now even more significant. We're hearing that at least 50% of the movie may be reshot. And they're adding one or two new characters who will be present throughout the entirety of the film.
Yeah, so that movie's just going to be garbage.
Yeah, that sounds pretty rough.
Yeah. I also, in the article, it says that Fox thinks it's not scary enough. And so
whatever that
right
means.
There, I'm like, okay, the studio is... The studio heard some of the hype or whatever, and now they're like... Instead of letting it be like a cohesive vision or whatever, they've decided, oh no, we've got a focus group this motherfucker to death. So I was already kind of hesitant about the New Mutants movie and sort of anything with the X-Men franchise going forward. I don't know. It's been so problematic.
Yeah, it is a crapshoot because... You'll get some really good ones and it'll give you faith again. And then they'll completely kick you in the balls in the next one.
if the pattern is anything to go off of, we're due for some stinkers because, you know, we just had Deadpool and Logan. And those were both objectively pretty good. You know, the X-Men Apocalypse, not so hot. So I just, the X-Men, like, title franchise, I'm like, whew, it's sort of on life support for me at this point.
Barely, yeah. And every bad movie that comes out sort of deletes the good ones.
And I feel like the fans are going to just sort of wait this out until the MCU, you know, if that merger goes through. I think fans are just kind of waiting for that to happen. And
for sure.
Really be interested.
It really does. I mean, it's been soft rebooted like three times within its own franchise.
Yeah.
But it needs just like a clean slate on that. New characters, new approach to the entire thing. I will say, though, you know, New Mutants didn't happen. I was a little sad about that because I do like the idea of the X-Men universe having like the broader sort of X teams. But then I saw the trailer to the new Deadpool. I'm like, this is an X-Force movie. Why aren't they just calling it X-Force? Well, I mean, other than to sell tickets.
That's exactly why. I'm actually glad that they're calling it Deadpool and, like, I don't know. X-Force, even the comics, I never thought were particularly great. You know, there's some good runs of it.
Sure.
But
I always like the concept of X-Force, and I like the characters. It was just, you know, straddled to that whole Rob Liefeld stuff.
But yeah, I think it's fun to introduce it through the world of Deadpool, and you know that precedent is there. Like, again, it's all sort of the Liefeld verse, and yeah. So I don't know. I'm excited to see fucking Shatterstar and Cable. You know, like,
yeah,
why not? And because it's a Deadpool movie, I don't have to have that sort of attachment to it where I'm like, oh, they gotta get X-Force right. It's like, well, they kind of don't, because as long as, you know, it's funny and entertaining the way the first Deadpool was, I'm gonna give it some slack.
Yeah, I'm actually more excited about Deadpool 2 having seen the new trailer and knowing what I know than I was originally, because I mean, I like the first Deadpool, but like, it's not the thing I, you know, crossed out days on my calendar for.
Yeah, no, I agree. The final trailer, I was like, oh, you get a sense of what the movie's actually about a little bit more.
Yeah.
And so far, I think it's set up to be pretty cool.
Yeah, but not so much with these other X-Men movies. Well, I guess we'll find out.
Nah, yeah, I'm not too excited about those.
Not too optimistic. Okay, last story. James Wan and Larry Stenitsky are teaming up for a remake of Stephen King's Tommyknockers. I always say remake, but that's a little bit of a misnomer. The first Tommyknockers movie, I'm putting in air quotes, was a TV miniseries, just like the It TV miniseries, which was a huge success with the remake of It last year. So I think this is going to be a new trend. Rebooting of these Stephen King miniseries, and I'm okay with that.
I am all about it, because when these miniseries were made, they none of them were the best quality. I was really into It from last year. I think there's something about like modern horror aesthetic that is really cool. But most of the time, I don't think the story's really there. So if you take sort of the modern horror aesthetic and attach it to, a story that is like from Stephen King. So, you know, I'm not going to say all of his stuff is solid. But, you know, if there's a little more...
There's usually a little bit more attention to stuff like characters and setting and things that other like generic Blumhouse movies usually don't concern themselves with.
Exactly. So I think it's a good thing for modern horror movies. You know, let's go back to the master of horror and give his stuff, an honest, worthwhile treatment.
Well, I think James Wan is a particularly talented director. You know, you say what you will about his work, but I think if you're looking at like what he does in the genre, it's pretty unparalleled, and he's certainly one of the most copied directors of late.
I honestly, I'm not too familiar with his stuff because I don't watch a lot of modern horror films.
I would say he's the one who pretty much set the precedent of that Blumhouse feel. Sure. And you know, he did the first Saw movie, which in that like created a whole genre. And then he did he did Insidious and The Conjuring, and those have set an entire genre. Along with Paranormal Activity, which he did not do. But yeah, I think like he kind of does generic tropey horror stuff, but he does it really, really, really well. And when you see other people trying to do his thing, you realize how well he does it.
I'm all about this. Like, yeah. I said, I think let's rack it all up.
And the Tommyknockers, I always thought was a pretty cool story. Like, I saw the movie when I was young enough to like not realize how shitty it was.
Is this the one where they're trapped in an airport?
No, this is the one where a group of
people... I'm thinking of the Langoliers.
This is the one where a spacecraft is buried underneath the Earth, and a large group of people become obsessed with trying to dig it up, and they're like losing their teeth and stuff from the radiation.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, it's a little bit outside of the like, you know, haunted, bad place kind of stories that you normally get from Stephen King. So I kind of like the sci-fi edge to it.
Yeah, well, I just hope that... I think Hollywood has kind of learned its lesson on Stephen King as far as, you know, let's actually pay respect to the source material. And I'm not saying, you know, let's not adapt stuff. But I think, you know, if you look at properties like The Lawnmower Man and shit like that, it's like basically just taking the name.
The Lawnmower Man has its own cult following. They released that recently on Scream Factory.
Okay.
I'm not saying anything about that, but
but you know what I mean? Like, there were a lot of these shitty movies that came out in the late 80s, early 90s that
I just think there was even shittier ones that came out in the late 90s, early 2000s. That, to me, was like, okay, I think we've scraped the bottom of the barrel on Stephen King. Once we started getting stuff like Dreamcatcher and Hearts of Atlantis and stuff like that.
Oh, I didn't know that was a Stephen King thing. But my point is, I think it's cool to see them like... It seems like the trend might be, judging from it and from this, is, well, let's take these books and give them, like, an honest go. You know, there's... Obviously, there is a commodity here, so let's try to you know, honor it and stuff. So, I'm into this.
Yeah, me too. I think it's all a good plan.
How are you gonna feel when the inevitable remake of The Shining happens?
Oh boy. I mean, we'll get into that with Ready Player One, I guess, won't we? Let's go ahead. Actually, let's start talking about that movie. And like I said, we got an audio clip from Jen, a friend of the show who worked on the movie. She did some special effects work and some motion capture stuff in England. She was gone all summer, and for about a year and a half, she wasn't able to tell anyone, including her closest friends and family, what she was working on until the movie's first trailer came out. So I asked her to give us some tidbits of what it was like working with Spielberg and such. So let's go ahead and listen to that.
Hi, my name is Jen, and I'm a fan of the podcast and also a friend of Cassidy's. And I work for a digital domain, which happened to work on Ready Player One. In 2016, they flew my virtual production crew over to England to help shoot the virtual production side of Ready Player One, which had to do with most of the mocap and previs and scene assembly that went on having to do with the Oasis. We had nothing to do with like the live action that was going on. Being on set with Spielberg was awesome. You know how you can see somebody and how they just command attention from everybody? There can be like 50 people in the room and everybody is just waiting to listen to what he has to say. That's what it was like to be in the same room with Spielberg. It was really weird, but he was the most down-to-earth person, and you could tell that he knew what he was doing, but he wasn't arrogant about it, if that makes sense. His ADs, his assistant directors, that's a different subject. they were, but I mean, that's their job, is to kind of boss people around and make people's life a living hell, which they did thoroughly. But that's fine. It's their job to keep the shoot going, basically. Me specifically, I worked on our ROM station, which is like the range of motion station. So we basically got our actors ready to go so that they could be on set in their mocap suits or motion capture suits and their head cams. And we made sure that their virtual skeleton was built before they could go on set. We really didn't really get to see a lot of what was happening. We could hear everything that was going on. But as far as tidbits, I don't know. It's kind of funny to share with my coworkers now parts of the movie that were rehearsed. Like, we would hear Ty Sheridan say different lines that were like, oh, they totally took that out of the movie. Or like, oh, that was my favorite line. In one of the parts when Parzival is calling people to help fight for the Oasis against the Sixers and IOI, he gives this huge long speech. And Ty Sheridan, he did so many different takes of this speech, and it was amazing every single time, but he wanted to get it perfect. And one of the lines that was actually cut, he calls, whatever, Sorrento was doing a total dick move. And we really, like, that was kind of a rallying cry because we heard it so many times when they were shooting it, and we really wanted that one line, total dick move, to end up in the final cut of the movie, but it ended up not being it. And I personally kind of feel like they butchered his whole speech at the end, knowing what it could have been. But I think John Williams was supposed to be the original composer of the score, and for some reason they got Alan Silvestri. I don't know if that was always the case, but I know in one scene when Parzival finishes the race and he goes into, I think it's Central Park, and he gets the first key, John Williams is supposed to be conducting in that scene. And I think it was cut out of the final edit. If John Williams is in there somewhere. But I know there were a lot of references to John Williams, but you know, intellectual properties, you can't get everything. And with a movie like Ready Player One, you can't get every single reference, or you can't get the rights to every single reference. So a lot of things that people have been saying, oh man, I wish this was in the book and I wish it was in the movie, you can't get everything. The movie would be like 5 hours long if it was a true adaptation of what the novel was. But I feel like the movie was a pretty good way of getting the gist of what the novel was about, and still holding on to the nostalgia and all the references that were made in the novel are in the movie. And when I saw it with a bunch of my coworkers who also went to England, we had a lot of fun with it, and we were laughing at the same things, you know, just thinking about our different memories of when we were on set watching it happen. And I thought it was a lot of fun, and I hope that a lot of people enjoyed it as well.
All right. And thank you for that, Jen. That's really cool.
That's fucking amazing, by the way.
Yeah.
And I get what she's saying about like Steven Spielberg having a presence. Like,
if he like walked him... into my work in the middle of the day, I would probably just forget to breathe. Like, there's not a lot of people who can like strike me. Is that a verb?
No. Well, it's just
he would definitely be one of them.
He's so just. I don't know. We saw him at Comic-Con, and you know, it was Hall H. We're thousands of feet away from him, and it's just like, it's, you know what I mean? He just has a presence.
Well, he's the man, you know, like he changed Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, couple times.
So just like the being able to work with him is obviously like a dream and insane. So that's super cool.
Yeah. And I talked to her a little bit online after she sent the audio, and I just basically kept asking her, was he nice? Because it would really like break my heart if I found out he was like a diva or like just a jerk on set. But he ended up being like super cool. So it worked out for me.
Well, I think he's one of those people that. You know,
the few that are that powerful and that rich and that successful who are still humble somehow.
Yeah. And he sort of has a reputation, you know, like a lot of these people, a lot of Hollywood people have a reputation. Like, you know, there's some that when you find out they're a dick, it's like, well, yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, if Steven Spielberg was, I agree.
William Friedkin was kind of prickly on set. I'm like, yeah, obviously. Have you seen his movies?
Yeah. So that is nice to hear that he was cool.
Well, let's get into the review then. Let's start talking about Ready Player One. Keith, describe to me what happens in Ready Player One.
All right. So this tech genius who created a virtual reality gaming internet called the Oasis dies, and he hid an Easter egg inside of the Oasis that players have to try to find through, you know, a series of challenges and trivia and knowledge. And they have to find this Easter egg because whoever finds it gets control, becomes his heir, and gets controlling stock of the Oasis and total control over it. So it's basically a virtual Willy Wonka.
A little bit, yeah. Kind of like Tron meets Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
But then there's also sort of like this whole kind of Hunger Games-ish thing going on, because it takes place in sort of a dystopian future where there's definitely like this, you know, wealth disparity and class thing going on.
Yeah. And we follow Wade Wilson. Wade Watts? Wade something.
Wade something. Yeah, Wade Wilson is Deadpool.
It's Wade Watts, I think, is his name. In the game, his avatar is known as Parzival. He meets up with... he has his friend Avatar H, and he meets up with this cute, sort of punky girl, Artemis... they sort of band together to try to reach the Easter egg before the evil corporation IOI can get it, so that they can just sell the Oasis for ad space.
Right. Yeah. So they're pretty much like this. You know, they have like more power than everybody, and they can pay hundreds of employees to work around the clock. Basically, it's like what was the rich one from Willy Wonka, who had like armies of people just unwrapping as many candy bars in a day as they can until she found the golden ticket.
Yeah.
So they have to beat the odds by being this sort of ragtag group of rebels against a giant corporation, essentially.
Yeah.
I tried to not know as much about it as possible. I've had lots of friends who are reading the book. I've had lots
of... Which I did.
Which you did, and I know other people who did as well, and I know lots of people who were more aware of what this was. I, like, literally tried not to read or know anything about this as little as possible.
I'm actually very, very curious what you thought about this movie, because I feel like this movie assumes a lot of the viewer. Like, there's some stuff that I'm like, I don't even know if you would know what that is or the significance of it, because it's and I guess we'll get sort of into my issues with it. So I made the mistake of reading the book first, which normally I don't do. Normally I do it in reverse, because of this very reason, where I'm like, well, that was better in the book. So I'm going to try not to reference the book too much. Just be aware that that definitely informed my viewing. There was some stuff that I actually think the movie did better. Like, obviously, when you have all these characters running around doing crazy stuff, it's, the book is pretty visual, you know, and there's references galore. So a lot of that was cool to see and really fun, like, especially the, like, the big battle scene at the end and stuff where you sort of have to imagine it. In the book, you know, like, that stuff's a pretty cool payoff of the movie. My problem with the movie is basically just the first act of it.
Agreed.
Doesn't do anything to really get you into this world. And I feel like there's so much that I think was important to the story, that is either changed or glossed over or deliberately altered to make more of an action sequence that really sort of bummed me out. So, like, the whole race sequence at the beginning, the whole first challenge to get the first key is completely different in the books. And I think, to me, that was, like, the most sort of egregious change, because there's so much about the character that is revealed through the first challenge that you, that is sort of cookie cutter in the movie. I think the movie does sort of a disservice to Wade, and Parzival, because he's just kind of there. And you don't really see what makes him, what separates him, like why he is going to be the one to go, you know, to go, why he has the potential to win this game. You know, like in Willy Wonka, Charlie gets to the end because of virtues. You know, in the movie Ready Player One, Wade is successful because,
and
you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Like, the movie doesn't really do anything to inform us about his character. I feel like we get to know at least some about the other characters, but not really him. He's just sort of a placeholder, male ingenue.
Yeah, he's kind of a just a cipher into the story. I mean, he sort of has the everyman Campbellian sort of thing going on.
In the book, I feel like this is done a lot better because we get a better sense of who he is as a character, and he's not entirely likable in the book. He's kind of a neckbeard mouth breather.
Right. He's a gamer, you know, like, kind of guy.
Yeah. And I mean, they make him, he still serves the purpose of a cipher and, you know, the hero in the book, but, you just get to see his flaws a little more and just sort of see, like, why he's the one we're following a bit more. Whereas in this, he's just sort of a placeholder.
He doesn't, in the movie, he doesn't have much of a personal arc. There's the arc of the story where, you know, this doesn't really give anything away, but by the end of the movie, we're all supposed to have, there's this big sort of revelation of, like, hey, we should appreciate real life and we should appreciate reality and we should try and make real connections and we shouldn't put all of our hopes and dreams and, you know, our stock into fantasy, blah, blah, blah. And that's all fine and well. Except for Wade himself other than that kind of revelation, which is sort of just packaged into the plot, he doesn't really have much of a personal arc. He's pretty much the same person by the end of the movie as he was at the beginning.
Yes. And that, so that's one of the big, I think, failures of the movie, as an adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
Again, is especially because a lot of that is laid out in the first sort of arc. And the book, I didn't realize this when I read it, but when I saw it as a movie, I was like, oh, this sort of has a perfect three-act structure in where he's trying to get these three keys, and each key is literally just like a different, you know what I mean?
I mean, it's built into the story, and it there is an aspect of the movie that is video game-like, and that I normally that annoys me in other types of stories, but in this, I kind of cut it some slack because it's obviously referencing the medium itself. So in a way, you know, like, you know, Scott Pilgrim kind of had a similar sort of structure, well, Wreck-It Ralph and movies like that that are referencing video games will build in sort of like a level playing.
Yeah. I think it's funny that the best video game movies aren't
based on actual video games. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's more about video game as a medium. Versus the actual story of any one particular video game.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, I had some issues with the first act. I felt like this movie is just throwing us into this world and doesn't do the things it needs to do to make the end pay off.
Agreed. I would say my biggest issues with the movies going into it was that it does kind of just throw you in the deep end and tries to teach you to swim by just throwing as much exposition at you in every frame as possible. Like it is so dense in exposition for the first two thirds of the movie that I was getting fairly frustrated with it when every line of dialogue is to explain something, and to just build the world and to just, get you grounded enough into the rules of the movie that you can actually start following it.
Man, it doesn't even...
I'm sure it doesn't even scratch the surface. But as a movie, yeah. I think a lot of that stuff you can do visually, you can do in other ways, you can parse it out different. Or
that's
you
sort
might
of what's...
just have to decide what's important and what's not. And there's a lot of this kind of like inside baseball stuff of the Oasis and like, you know, the history of the Oasis and all this stuff that maybe doesn't need to be explained in dialogue.
Well, okay, so
that was an issue I had for the first big chunk of the movie, and I was
and that's why the first act frustrates me is because I felt like the book disperses that in a better way, but they sort of traded that for a nonsense action sequence with this big race, if that makes sense.
I would argue that that's one of the ones we maybe needed only because that is a plot point.
It's not though. Like it's totally different and sort of changes the stakes and the value of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I didn't want to do this, but I feel like I have to, in the book. Yeah. In the book, it's very much merit based on how much you know about this creator, and that it explains like why, in particular, these Gunters are so 80s obsessed because this creator is, and you know the clues are hidden there, and it is much more cerebral. Well, so like you know, there's whereas in the movie, it's like. It's a race with a trick. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know what? I'll actually push back on that a little bit. I think that comes through. It might maybe didn't as much for you because it was probably a much more emotionally grounded in the book. But I got the idea that, you know, this Halliday character that Mark Rylance plays, which I think he's great in, by the way. He's one of the more riveting performances in the movie.
And yeah, I thought he was
above it, but But yeah, I think that I got that through the movie, through the flashback sequences.
Okay.
I understand.
You didn't get it as good, though.
I felt like I got that good enough. I think his, the integration of Halliday and his memories and how that affects the Oasis. Because I'll say one of the things I was really worried about going into this movie is this just going to be nostalgia of the motion picture? Is this just going to be, hey, do you remember this? Do you remember that? Is this going to be I Love the 80s, the movie?
Yeah, because that the book gets that I think isn't totally fair. I mean, it's definitely a movie about nostalgia. And
yes and no. I actually think that the movie is surprisingly more subversive than that. And I was prepared to hate that part of it. So I like if anything had triggered me on that level, I was ready to hate it, but
all right,
it didn't. And even when we, you know, have a whole sequence in the middle of the movie, an action sequence that takes place in the Overlook Hotel, and you know that's hallowed ground for me. Like you don't fuck with Kubrick or The Shining. But that was probably my favorite sequence in the movie for two reasons. It is it has the most air out of all of the set pieces. It's not just filling the frame constantly with something, because they had to kind of sort of play by those Kubrick rules in that universe. It breathes a little better than the rest of the movie.
Yes.
It doesn't seem as out of breath.
This was one of my favorite parts of the movie too, because in general, I think the movie has a huge pacing problem. In the book, this quest has taken years for people just to discover, like, the first clue.
Yeah.
And in this, we're just, like, shoved right into the action, and it feels like this movie takes place over, like, maybe 2 days.
Because of the pacing. And I'll say, like, you know, comparing it to Willy Wonka, the big difference between Willy Wonka and this movie, I mean, there's lots of differences, but, you know, on a structural level.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time with Charlie and his family and them, like, laying in their bed in their onesies and, like, you know, singing ridiculously boring songs like Cheer Up Charlie. Like, we don't have that in this movie.
I think, a problem.
Yeah. It, Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory, like, does a little better job of establishing the world, establishing who the players are, literally.
Well, Willy Wonka,
sort of what the stakes are. This movie is, like, trying to get you familiarized with all that stuff while also doing set pieces at the same time. And it's a little bit like juggling and riding a bike at the same time.
Yeah. And that's, again, I think that's why the first sort of third is way better in the book, is because you really get a sense of why Wade needs to win this competition. You know, because his life is pretty awful.
I'll say for me, the movie picks up significantly.
Yeah.
Once we meet Olivia Cook as Artemis, who we just talked about her in Thoroughbreds, a very different movie. But she's great in this movie as well. And I thought that once I could see them together as human beings, and once I could kind of put a face to the avatar and that kind of stuff, then I suddenly became a lot more invested in the story. And I also, like, that's when the movie starts to slow down on the exposition. And that's when I think things start to lock in a little more.
So that's interesting to hear, because that is very different in the book. But I agree with you. Whereas I know other people, like both the Ashleys, were sort of upset with the way she was introduced in the movie, because it's so different than the book. Yeah, but I agree. I think it worked in the movie where it was structurally.
Mm-hmm.
I think because we spent this whole first part of the movie with exposition and set pieces, that, yeah, we needed to slow down. We needed to see sort of the real world for a little bit,
mm-hmm.
And see some of the stakes.
And you know, I talked a little bit about this with Jen online, and I said, while it felt like to me, like the movie was kind of moving at me in pieces at a million miles an hour, and I had to sort of grab onto the little bits of like character and story that I could to be able to invest at all. It was hard work, but by the movie's end, by the time we're getting to the big climactic battle and it's him versus Ben Mendelsohn as the bad guy, and like he's going for the egg and the key and all this stuff, I was surprised how invested I was and how like riveting like the last few set pieces were. And like, right, you know, I was on the edge of my seat and I was actually cared if he achieved his goal. But it did feel like a lot of work getting there.
Okay.
But
yeah, no, I had sort of similar feelings. Like the first chunk of the movie, I'm like, oh boy. And then as it sort of goes on, I think, yeah, the sort of tide shifted again at that Shining sequence. Mm-hmm. Because now we're seeing why this is why this works as a movie.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing that, oh, okay, he's referencing, not only is he referencing The Shining,
he's recreating big swaths.
Exactly. Yeah. We're getting to see that.
I'll say on a technical level, a very seamless representation, because there was stuff in there where it's like that had to have come from like actual footage from the movie, and then there's stuff that's obviously recreation, then there's stuff that's obviously digital, and I it was very tough to like see where one ends and the other begins. Like
I also think there was some cool stuff. Like I dug the world of the Oasis versus the real world. Like I do think visually it was, you know, I'm not normally a fan of like overly CGI stuff, and I think with Spielberg in particular, sort of the mocap,
yeah,
in his later work isn't effective. But because we're in a video game, to me, I'm like, this visually makes sense, and I liked that just about everything in the real world seemed pretty practical, mm-hmm. and everything in the Oasis was digital. I thought that visually that really worked.
I wasn't crazy about Parzival and Artemis's character design, especially since they're the ones we're supposed to be emotionally connecting with the most, especially like their like romance and stuff, which I'm not really feeling until I see them as humans. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what you would do there. I mean, he kind of looks a little Kingdom Heart-ish, which...
Yeah.
And she looks like some weird fish punk rocker pixie girl. That's fine. There's just something about motion capture facial stuff that I don't think we're totally 100% there yet as far as being able to make human emotional connections with.
I think that sort of plays into the themes of the movie.
Yeah, it is a little bit more cleverly integrated that way. But I will say, like, Leanna Waithe, I guess is her name. She was in Master of None. Loved her character in the movie.
Okay.
TJ Miller I liked a lot.
Well, so...
His little...
Leanna Waithe... You needed to go back and edit in the fucking spoiler thing, because...
We don't have to say what character she is, but she plays a cool character.
Okay.
I liked... and I liked the reveal, and I thought it was totally natural, and...
I see, that part was hard for me, because I felt like they kind of bungled that, and it had a way... To me, it was a lot more significant in the book, and to me, that moment just felt... like really flat.
Well, let's be real here. When it comes to emotional weight, when it comes to things like Ty Sheridan's family being killed, or when it comes to like that reveal with Lena Waithe, or when it comes to things like the romance between Olivia Cooke and Ty Sheridan, those kinds of emotional things, the movie more or less doesn't work. Those are the things that and those things are big deals for me, because you're talking about story, but those are the things that I think are kind of left to the wayside for spectacle. And for
yes, I think- and I think honestly, I really think that Spielberg wasn't really interested in them because
maybe not. So I don't know. I think that would be weird if he wasn't. But the book
has a lot of complex themes and stuff. And mm-hmm. I know Ernest Cline has gotten a lot of flack as a writer for sort of how dense it is with pop culture references.
Sure.
I feel like the book is, say what you will about some of the writing, I do think it works on a lot of thematic levels. And I think for this, Spielberg really chose to just focus on the technology metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
In sort of the futurism, mentality,
mm-hmm.
and the economic themes.
Yes, this is why I ended up liking it a lot more than I thought I would, and why I thought that it was actually kind of about something. Because if it had just been, you know, video games are fun, woohoo movie, then I'd really not care. But the fact that...
Yeah, but I mean, the book isn't like that.
Yeah, but it would have been easy to do that with the movie.
Sure.
But the fact that the movie, I think, really, it's essentially a movie about net neutrality. Like,
well,
I mean,
the crazy thing is the book was written before net neutrality even existed.
Well, I don't know how old the book is, but that's been a battle going on a good 5 years.
Yeah, the book, I think, was from 2011. And I think net neutrality didn't even exist until, wasn't it like 2014 or something?
No, the FCC has been going at it for a while. It's just the people online have been able to sort of...
No. I know, but net neutrality itself didn't actually exist. It might have been a little earlier than that. It might have been right around the time the book was written.
It was kind of hanging in the balance. There was no legislation to specifically mandate net neutrality, but there was enough there that the FCC couldn't do too much. And then there was some regulation put in 2014, I think, 2014-15, and then it's just been repealed. So,
yeah.
This has been in sort of the pop culture zeitgeist for a while, and I think this movie, you know, either on purpose or not, really kind of pulls that into the themes and does so very well on a larger
yes.
scale, on a more broader scale. I think that there's kind of like this very socialist bent to the movie. I'll just say it. I think that this movie is obviously, you know, like you. One of the big things about it is that the creator of this game sort of wanted to create a world in which there was no hierarchies, and
yeah.
he wanted everyone to sort of have stake in this game. He didn't really want you know, one person to be able to throttle it, and then you have this bad guy character Sorrento who wants to essentially do just that. He wants to make it so that you have to pay to play. And pay more to have more access. And that is the larger battle that's going on between the two is who controls
yeah.
the means of production, literally. And that's, you know, for a big, giant studio blockbuster that people are going to go see in a mall, that's pretty fucking cool.
No, I agree. And I think that is where the movie is successful. I think the movie is successful at... making me want to be a part of the Oasis, making, you know, sort of fulfilling the visual promise of the book.
Are you going to be one of those Avatar people who go off themselves because they'll never be able to experience whatever the fuck that planet was called?
Yeah. yeah. So there's that aspect of it. The sort of futurist wet dream and morality tale, you know, because you have like the payment centers, which is pretty fucked up.
Right. Yeah.
So I think the movie's successful at achieving at visually paying off the sort of techno geek aspect of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's successful at capturing, you know, sort of this class battle.
Mm-hmm.
I think it actually sort of pulls back a little on the reference and nostalgic nature of the book, which I think is
probably
good
for the better. Yeah. I mean,
in some ways, although I do think the book weaves some of that in some pretty clever ways as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the movie sort of fails at, the character
stuff, the story stuff. Yeah. That is definitely sort of what gets sacrificed. But we're talking about, you could say the same thing about Blade Runner. You could say the same thing about Tron. You could say that about a lot of movies that are now sort of seen as sci-fi classics. And I'm not saying that this movie is going to be held in that kind of regard. Probably not.
Yeah, it's just sort of frustrating to me because I know some of that is there,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the story. And I can see that it got, you know, and there's some stuff that I think worked better in the movie. I don't want to just be like, the book was better. Like, Irock's character is barely in the book. Mm-hmm. And I thought, TJ Miller's character,
mm-hmm.
and I thought the movie used him in really fun, cool ways and really made him a part of the story in a way that the book, he's just sort of a Gunter wannabe, and he's in like one scene.
Yeah.
And so when I heard that, you know, TJ Miller was playing him, I'm like, really? Man, they must have totally rewritten his character, which they did. But I think in ways that
help
the movie makes him better.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the same with Sorrento. I think Ben Mendelsohn does a great job of making this corporate stooge who we really get a sense of how much he does not give a fuck about this game, which I think is really fun. And I think the movie sort of pulls that off better as well. So I do think
towards the end, when Mendelsohn's in his weird like gamer throne and they have the helmets on and they're like creating like little realities within the realities and stuff, and they're like doing this little sneak around his building, I was getting kind of like 90s like hackers cyberpunky vibes.
Yeah,
from the movie.
And I thought that was really
fun.
And
I kind of enjoyed that. It got kind of like pulpy in a fun way.
So yeah, I do think the movie made some changes to the book that I do think are for the better. So I don't want it to just seem like it's not the book, so it's trash. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the case at all. The argument I keep using for people who are like, well, it's so much different than the book, I'm like, yeah, so was Jurassic Park.
Yeah, so was Jaws.
Yeah, so, you know, I kind of knew with Spielberg, there's going to be that's just what happens with adaptations.
Right.
But I do think...
I think maybe as far as that goes, people are a little more spoiled now, because if you look at like the Harry Potter movies or the Hunger Games movies or the Twilight movies, yes, I'm sure the book readers can find ways.
They're truncated, but they're still
too. But those are a lot more slavishly adapted than like the usual Spielberg thing.
Yeah, I mean, even Game of Thrones, right. You know, which has some pretty far departures, tries to stay pretty close to the books.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that's part of it. I think maybe that maybe it feels like a little bit more of a betrayal with this particular property because it's something the characters would hate. Because you know, so much of the story is dedicated to slavish nostalgia and perfect accuracy. Like, there's a part in the book where he has to go, instead of The Shining, he has to go through War Games.
Okay.
And he literally has to quote the entire, it's either War Games or Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I can't remember.
Well, just two pretty different movies other than Matthew Broderick.
both are referenced, I can't remember which one he has to, but literally he has to like live out the movie and quote it word for word. Right. So like
that would have been probably annoying. And if it was something as obscure as War Games, would have been lost on just no, about
and they changed that to The Shining, and what they did with that, I think, worked for a movie a lot better. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that maybe that's why people are a bit more up in arms about this particular adaptation, because that sort of slavish nostalgia and dedication to source material is literally a part of the story.
So there might be also a slight extra textual thing going on here with Steven Spielberg. If you were to think of him as sort of casting himself as Halliday, right?
Yeah.
So, like, in this case, Spielberg sort of gets to make all the references he loves. And he was a huge fan of Kubrick. He was good friends with Kubrick towards the end of his life. They had had many conversations about the Shining. And so, well, like, why wouldn't he
also
want to...
Also, the Iron Giant is... The, you know, that cartoon feels very Spielbergian.
Sure.
And in the book, the Iron Giant is literally just like one reference.
Right.
They mention him once, but, you know, he's not in the big battle at the end. And for one, I was like, oh, yay, Iron Giant. I'd rather see him than this obscure anime mech that he ends up getting.
Right, exactly. So I think that if you look at it in that under that lens of, you know, Halliday is sort of Spielberg, his cipher in the movie, then you can kind of see this other sort of theme in there about a creator and his references and what he grew up with and what he loves and sort of how he expresses that through his own art.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's definitely there. Okay, so final thoughts.
I liked it. I didn't love it. I do think I like the sort of anti-capitalist socialist rant of the movie, and I think that that's subversive and weird and kind of cool for a big budget movie like this. It's made for by a corporation. You know, it's not, I always say about like stuff like Hunger Games, it's not my Star Wars, but it's probably going to be somebody's. I give it a B minus.
Okay. My final thoughts are it's different than the book. That's okay. The book does some things better. The movie does some things better. And ultimately I had a lot of fun with it. I think it is, visually it's a fun ride. I do think there. Yeah. I actually gave it the same grade, a B minus.
Cool. All right, let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework, which I assigned you last week. This is Half Nelson, and I think I made the mistake of saying that this was directed by the same guy who directed, what did I say? Some big lie.
You said it was the same guy who directed Lars and the Real Girl.
Yes, that is not. The guy who directed Lars and the Real Girl ended up doing I, Tonya, but Ryan Fleck did a movie after this, a football movie called Sugar. That was his main follow-up to this, but this was released in 2006, and I remember this being one of The Notebook being the two big movies that really launched Ryan Gosling, one in sort of his indie sphere and then one in sort of like the pretty leading man. This is a sort of a drama, an indie drama about a high school teacher. White high school teacher played by Ryan Gosling, who is in the inner city, sort of the poorer African-American neighborhoods, and he's doing a big course specifically on civil rights. And he's trying to get through his school year while at the same time secretly battling a pretty debilitating addiction to crack and cocaine and whatever else he can get his hands on. He's been in and out of rehab his whole life. He's lost friends and family along the way. He's trying to maintain as best as he can, and not doing the greatest job at it. He has a friend named Dre, a young girl who's sort of the only person who knows his secret, but she's keeping it. And they have, because of that, she has a little bit of an edge over the other students. She sort of knows him in a way that everyone else doesn't. And he's sort of able to hopefully parlay that familiarity into something of a mentorship, which is obviously kind of awkward and not conventional. But he tries to do his best to keep her from being corrupted by the things in her life, which is obviously really difficult for him, seeing as how he doesn't have a whole lot of room to talk. So, Half Nelson, what did you think?
This movie was a bummer.
It's rough.
Yeah, there are some scenes that are... did you ever watch 30 Rock?
No. I mean, not a lot of it.
There's this really funny joke that's one of my favorite jokes of the series where Tracy Morgan's character, Tracy Jordan, mm-hmm. is trying to be taken more seriously as an actor. Mm-hmm. So he stars in a movie that's literally called Hard to Watch. it's one of my favorite jokes. That's sort of what this was like for me. I was like, mm-hmm. I get this is good, but fuck. Ryan Gosling, you have my heart, even if you are a crack addicted school bad teacher. Influence. No, I mean, here's the thing. It's definitely a character piece. This movie definitely is trying to send a message.
For sure.
But I don't think it comes off as preachy, which I think when you get into sort of, inner city, black schools and
right. This could turn into Lean on Me. It could turn into Dangerous Minds. It could turn into, it's sort of a cliched story trope.
Yeah. So I actually thought it was cool that the teacher's the white teacher is the one that's fucked up. Mm-hmm. And that his life is garbage, and for the most part, the only student whose background life we get to see is Dre, and she seems like a pretty normal kid, her mom works hard and she works long hours, but her life hasn't gone down that road.
No.
But she has this family friend of her brother who is in jail. Mm-hmm.
Anthony Mackie,
yeah, who is a drug dealer, and he's like real charming and real fun to be around. Mm-hmm. And he is definitely sort of this like temptation or doorway into this world for her,
right?
So it's interesting. I think this movie has a lot of cool dynamics and a lot of interesting stuff going on. It's not just a preachy, don't do drugs sort of sermon morality tale.
Yeah, there's a lot of contradictions in the movie as far as the characters go, and in a good way, where mm-hmm. we set them up to be one thing, and then you sort of find, like, there's this one really great scene in the movie where Ryan Gosling's going to confront Anthony Mackie and actually have the gall to tell him to stay away from this girl while he's, like,
especially
crack
because
in a
like
bathroom.
Anthony Mackie has this like weird family attachment. It's like, who the fuck is this guy?
Yeah, exactly.
Coming up to me.
And he's so kind of like guilt stricken and even feeling like he has to do this, that they sort of have this moment of recognition of each other. It's really well directed in that way where, you get this whole story in each of their heads without either of them having to say it.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in general. There's a lot of stuff that goes unsaid. Mm-hmm. Like there's an early scene in a locker room bathroom that is one of the hardest things I've ever had to watch mm-hmm. on screen. It is heartbreaking and traumatizing and super fucked up. Mm-hmm. And almost, like, got me out of the movie. I was almost like, I can't fucking do this after that scene. Mm-hmm. But then the way that is sort of dealt with is, I think, so well done. this could be like the whole movie sort of hinges on this scene. And it does, but it's not overt. It's not obvious. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff that's implied. Another scene where I think there's more that's not said than that is said mm-hmm. is late in the movie when Ryan Gosling goes back home.
Oh, yeah.
The scene with his family.
Yeah.
Is, I think, a masterstroke in writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much that's implied that you can infer that has happened, but you don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never said. And so there's so much that's left to interpretation, but there's only one logical conclusion.
Right. And, kind of almost the opposite of Ready Player One in that sense. That scene deals with so much exposition that is never actually like in dialogue.
No, yeah, that's what I mean. It's so well written and so well acted.
Yeah.
At certain points in the movie, there is some, I think, a little bit of filler stuff that sort of follows the trope of the inner city school movie.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I'm not going to say is bad, because it's not, but it's just not working on the same level as sort of these key scenes.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
I felt that the movie's pretty lean. I didn't feel too much fluff here.
No, it's just that there's certain scenes that are so directed that, and there are other scenes that less so, if that makes sense. That I can really feel sort of a director's touch of what we're going to show and what we're not.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's done purposefully. And I think it's done in meaningful ways. Sort of, you know, when he's in his everyday life,
yeah,
those scenes are less impactful.
Well, I think the director really wants to challenge us, and Ryan Gosling with his performance, wants to challenge us to... I know I was thinking this myself while watching it. It's like, could this work? Like, could you be that fucked up and be able to still do this job? Like, because it seems kind of far-fetched, right? Like, that's the hook. It's like, it's a movie about a teacher who's also a crack addict. And, you know, they make it seem plausible enough for the first little while in the movie. You're like, I guess, like, you know, there's probably a lot of teachers that are probably pretty bad alcoholics, but we don't have to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then the movie goes where it goes, but it's...
Well, that's what I mean. I think
the challenge of like seeing him in the class doing sort of the everyday, like, I'm the cool teacher thing is to see, like, it's to challenge us and think, like, maybe this isn't necessarily a problem.
Yes. No, I that's what I mean when I say I think it's intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Because those scenes that we're talking about have a lot more tension to them.
Because of that.
They feel a lot more hands-on because they are so important.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas those other scenes don't, but I think that's a good thing. I think that is a good thing that Ryan Gosling is a likable teacher. Because there's got to be something that pulls you in to the tension of the movie. Otherwise, it's just, oh, God, he's, you know what I mean?
Right.
Honestly, this, if you want a tonal comparison, I don't think you've seen it, but this sort of felt like a movie version of the fourth season of The Wire.
Oh.
And people who have seen the fourth season of The Wire will be going, oh, okay. I want to see this movie now.
Well, yeah, I can't speak to that, but it worked for me. And, you know, there's this kind of overarching theme of like civil rights, and they break up the movie with these little monologues that the kids doing their presentations on these civil rights leaders, and they cut to stock footage. And I kept mm-hmm. wondering, I was like, how does this tie in exactly? I mean, he's a white guy in like a black neighborhood, but other than that, like, what's going on here? Until we get to that scene with him, Ryan Gosling with his family, and then that all kind of locked into place.
I think it locked into place with the scene with the confrontation with Anthony Mackie.
Yeah, kind of a 1-2 punch there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, here's the thing. Yeah, let's wrap this up. Unless you have anything, any other specific things to talk about. It's really good. It's really well directed. Mm-hmm. Ryan Gosling is fucking terrific. The whole cast is.
Yeah, that girl is amazing.
Shrika Epps is so fucking good. Mm. And their chemistry is so fucking good. And this movie did something that I think is hard for movies to do that are dramatic like this. Mm-hmm. In that I felt like their friendship was genuine. Without it going to, like, a weird sexual place.
Okay, yeah.
You know, like, I always sort of expect this weirdness to happen, and the movie doesn't go there, and thank God it doesn't.
Yeah, well, I think it's another one of the things that the movie's sort of challenging us with, is it's like, is this appropriate? Like,
no, it's absolutely not, but it's not for those reasons.
Right, yeah, but we're kind of...
Yeah, and I was just glad that the movie... didn't ever make that a thing.
Right, agreed.
That's all I wanted to say.
I agree.
The movie doesn't go there.
And doesn't need to, and it would have been... really just turned into emotional pornography at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So this movie's good. The performances are great. I'll probably never watch it again because it is a total bummer.
Yeah, I really liked it a lot. And it was... yeah, I really can't say a whole lot against it. I think what it does so well is it does play with a lot of tropes that we've seen 1,000 times, and it could get kind of predictable or actory or whatever you want to say about it, and it never actually does that. And I think that's the achievement of the movie, is it sort of avoids all of those cliches or tropes in its genre. And turns out a lot of great performances. Didn't mention the movie is almost exclusively scored by the Broken Social Scene's best work.
Yeah.
there were some moments
that I actually thought that was a little weird. But
that's the one thing in the movie that definitely puts it in its year. You're like, oh, this is 2006.
Like, yeah.
Really 2006. Yeah. But yeah, it worked for the tone of the movie. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, I appreciate it for what it is. I enjoyed it. It's just it's a mood movie. Like it's definitely not like fun.
No, it'll put you in a funk. It'll put you in a
funk.
Okay, Keith, what did you want to have us watch next week?
Next week we're going to watch the Bob Odenkirk written and starring Netflix original from last year called Girlfriend's Day.
All right. And if anybody has any opinions about Ready Player One or Half Nelson or Girlfriend's Day or whatever else, you can email us with those at jabberandrone@gmail.com. If you want to drop in some audio like Jen did this week, you can do it that way. Or if you just want to write a couple lines, some hot takes, we can read it on air. Also, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Jabber Podcast, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can read my movie reviews I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at Salad Fork Reviews. .blogspot.com. You can find a regular podcast archives at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com, and you can stream us at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. And you can follow the show on Instagram at Jabber Podcast. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
It should be.
Yeah, it's the same as our Twitter.
Yeah. Where do people find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Keith Foster Kid, and that's pretty much it for now.
Okay. We have some friends who do podcasts you should be listening to that include Rod and Denise at The Listening Party, Denise's Mascot Diaries. You have Patrick over at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational, and Bill and Brian at the Great Albums Podcast. Mike Fallick over at Let's Start a Cult, which apparently he just put out an episode with Todd Glass.
Yeah, I saw that. That's
pretty cray.
Cool.
I'll have to listen to it to find out what's going on there, but that's pretty cray if that is what happened.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to Adam Connie and the Adamant podcast, and Meryl and Beau who do Campfire Shit Show. Yeah, those are all for this week.
Cool. Then we'll talk to you later.
Don't give it to Gosling because he's going to smoke it.
Bye.